Good evening, Panacea Health Program coming out every Tuesday night. I'm Quentin Strawley. Tonight again, we have this opportunity where you can support us to keep us back on air. You can visit our website to find out the details. Now, on this program, we cover the Bio Blitz that's happening on Friday and Saturday. The psychological research behind the Facebook data breach. The potential return of a Sydney hydrofoil. And the benefits of black tea. All that coming up in the next half hour.
Be crowned the 3x3 basketball champions of UTS. Students and staff can enter the free 3x3 basketball tournament Saturday, April 14 at UTS Sports Hall. Book your spot now or enter a team on the Activate UTS website. That's activateuts.com.au. Everyone can play it, watch it, wear it at UTS Sport. Saturday, April 14, UTS Sports Hall starts at 9 a.m. Activate UTS sponsors 2SER 107.3.
With parks, wetlands and playground galore, Sydney Parks is certainly a jewel in the crown of the bustling Sydney city. This weekend, the park will be on display with scientists, naturalists and locals heading over to the Sydney Park for BioBlitz. The weekend is jam-packed with fun, educational events designed to teach Sydneysiders about the impressive array of wildlife living in the very heart of our city. On Friday the 13th, BioBlitz will begin with a spooky start. After the sun goes down, the park will turn their eyes to the sky, taking part in a night microbat survey, a mixture of science and festival of fun. BioBlitz will be holding a barbecue along with the 21 different events happening from the 13th to the 14th of April. From spotlighting surveys to guided bike tours through the Alexandria Canal, BioBlitz is sure to reveal some fascinating facts about our history with the many creatures crawling around. Nick Healy spoke to Jess Scully, the festival director of BioBlitz, to find out more about the event happening this weekend.
21 guided scientific surveys happening with, you know, people from the community and scientists on hand. What are we hoping to discover out of this? Because it's huge.
It is huge. And as you were saying, there's this surprising ecosystem at Sydney Park. You know, when I go there, I mostly see dogs. It's the main form of wildlife, frolicking in the dog pond and the dog fountain. But apparently there are peregrine falcons, there are emerald spotted tree frogs, there's owls, there's blue-tongued lizards. They've even seen migratory birds come through from Siberia in the park. So what this is all about is really getting citizen scientists out there to document this incredible diversity of species.
I think this is fantastic because, you know, you don't think about this happening in the middle of a city.
No, and you're right. Sydney Parks had this fascinating history, you know, brickworks, then rubbish tip, then remediated site, and now look at it. It really shows what's possible when we take these sorts of places that have been through a lot and give them some love and regenerate them into new environments. So, I had no idea there was so much going on there.
Look, I know Sydney Park's been a big focus for the city and, you know, they've really done an incredible job of reclaiming that.
And not only that, it also is really important in terms of treating water and trying to improve air quality. And there are so many people. There's tens of thousands of people who live in this area, in Alexandria, in Green Square, even down as far as Mascot. It's kind of the lung, but also the backyard of the city for so many thousands of people. And it'd be wonderful to learn a bit more about it. So that's why we're asking everyone to get involved in BioBlitz.
I think it's fantastic. And also, you're not just getting people out there, you know, spotlighting, although that's a big focus of it. It's a bit of a little cultural festival as well.
Yes, I love that there's an Aboriginal cultural tour because it'd be amazing to get a sense of what this city was like and how it was used, you know, before colonization. And there's also, of course, there's a barbecue.
There's got to be a barbecue. Of course there's a barbecue.
Taronga Zoo are coming, and they're going to give us some more information as well. But I think the nighttime spotlighting sounds really cool too. But there's so many things. As you said, there's 21 different events that are on. So whatever you're into, whenever you've got a bit of time this weekend, there's probably something that you could do.
There is something you could do, and especially the bike rides look particularly interesting. I know you've got a guided ride that's the history of the canal in the area, and also, weirdly, insect insight, something you don't normally want to find when you're riding a bike, surely.
Really? Wow. I mean, the canal's also fascinating because, you know, that whole area used to be wetlands, and then it was industrialized as the Alexandria Canal. So learning about what it was, how it worked when it was this industrial heartland, and then also now what it could be. You know, we've spent a lot of time and money as the city trying to make the Alexandria Canal a nicer place for Sydneysiders and a transport route as well. So be great for everyone to learn a little bit more about it.
I think it's, yeah, it would be absolutely amazing to learn as much about it as we can. And I guess, you know, Sydney Park and that area, in a real way, it's a bit of a jewel in the crown of the city of Sydney in terms of what you can do with a bit of effort and a bit of patience.
Absolutely. I mean, Clover started working on Sydney Park, I think, pretty soon after she got elected, so, you know, 14 years ago. And this is what happens when you really dedicate time and resources to a place. And yeah, it is a jewel in the crown. I love going there, and it's so well used all the time. And there's a lot more coming for Sydney Park. There's also a really fantastic new skate park that'll open, I think, next year. I think they'll start building it very, very shortly too. So it's come down and enjoy it. We'll be there all weekend.
Look, I'm pretty excited for it. I'm going to try and get down there. We'll have details up on 2ser.com, but I know people can go to whatson.cityofsydney.newsouthwales.gov.au and find the details.
That was Nick Healy speaking to Jess Scully, the Festival Director of BioBlitz. And this is the time of the year, of course, when we're looking for donations again, so please visit our website to support us. Now, there's a study out that, in fact, if you have a couple of cups of tea a day without milk, they actually contribute to health. To discuss this, to find out all about the details, let's turn to a regular contributor, Russell Setwright, who's a practicing naturopath in New South Wales. Now, Russell, what's this about not adding milk to your tea and improving your health?
Well, actually, it was drinking black tea. Not green tea, but drinking black tea, 2 cups a day.
Right.
Lower blood pressure and improve artery stiffness. In other words, more flexibility in the arteries, which is very interesting.
Would you get any improvement with the milk as well, or does that affect it?
I think they're finding actually adding milk takes it away.
All right.
Yeah, so those studies they looked at ages ago on green tea and found that milk was detrimental. But green tea and milk, you wouldn't put milk in green tea. The taste is pretty average. So most of the studies of benefit have said, and I really think it's not the milk that does it, I think it's diluting it that probably makes a difference, that you're not having as much.
Okay.
And therefore you're missing out on the catechins, which are the antioxidants in green tea and black tea. But this study was done on black tea because everyone's focused on green tea and health.
Yes.
But not many people have focused on the black tea. We can understand, see, black tea's a diuretic as well.
Yes.
So being a diuretic, it gets rid of fluid, and that can have an effect on blood pressure. So that could be why it lowers blood pressure. And the catechins, the antioxidant properties, preventing cholesterol and things from being oxidized, because that's what they can help prevent that oxidization. And if then the oxidized cholesterol on the artery wall migrates into the artery wall and hardens up the artery. So it would slow down that progression. So, you know, a couple of cups of tea a day. And, of course, 2 cups of green tea. It was 4 cups of green tea and 2 cups of black tea. But when you put this together, the Japanese green tea cups are much smaller than the English black tea cups. Oh. So they're probably about the same quantity.
Right, okay. Now, it's a diuretic, which obviously can help people with going to the lavatory. But what else can they do if they've got incontinence?
Look, the thing is that the amount people think they shouldn't drink, it's when you have your drink that's the thing. You need to drink, but you only need to drink when you're thirsty. And as long as you're not taking vitamin B,
right.
You should pass clear at least once a day. Now, if you do that, That's probably the guidelines to how much you drink. A lot of people think, oh, I must drink 8 to 10 glasses a day, and then they don't count all of the fruit and other things they've had, and they've had a lot more water than they actually need. There's never been any real studies to say, but I know the Australian Army did a lot of studies in the measuring the amount of fluid and dehydration, and they found, make sure you drink when you're thirsty. If you've got a dry mouth and you think, gee, I'm thirsty, then have some water. Don't use alcohol, coffee or tea as those drinks because they're mild diuretics.
Yeah.
And you'll find that that will help with incontinence because you're taking the pressure off the bladder and you haven't got that full bladder. The other thing is, of course, we've got prolapse with women and prostate problems with men that increase that problem as well. So, you know, if it's prostate, then taking saw palmetto, there's a product called Procerin that can help. And that's been shown to reduce the amount of having to get up out of bed during the night. But, you know, if you're going to have cups of tea at night, expect to get up because it's a diuretic.
Yeah, indeed, yes. And of course, I suppose I read in somewhere that men have an automatic trigger when they get up to 350 mils and women about 250.
Yeah, that's right. And they've got to go, and that's exactly right. So the big thing is, don't drink just before bed, but make sure you're drinking when you're thirsty up to then. But going without water deliberately gives a concentration overnight, and that increases the risk of infection. And a lot of people who get cystitis is because they don't want to get during the night, so they don't drink from lunchtime, virtually, and they've got this concentrated urine without much water there, and that's a risk too. So drink normally, but not just before bed, and you'll find that that'll help. Now, that's when milk before bed can be beneficial because of the tryptophan in it. It can help you sleep too.
And the magnesium in the milk as well can relax the muscles, can't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So there are a couple of the things, but exercise, floor exercises to strengthen the pelvic muscles is very good as well. But the main thing is that we do know, and we always talk about high cholesterol being bad and hardening the arteries, but we don't really get taught about the antioxidant properties of food, because we do know that taking vitamin C improves elasticity of the arteries. We know that people who eat blueberries or take blueberry supplements and take antioxidants reduce the incidence of oxidization or rancidity of fats like cholesterol, and that in turn reduces the incidence of these building up in the artery wall. And that's what all of these tea studies are showing, because they're very high in antioxidants.
Well, I also heard that blueberries can actually help with eyesight as well, even.
Absolutely. Bilberry or blueberry is excellent for helping with the particularly night vision, and there's a lot of studies to say that it's beneficial. See, because we've got fingers and thumbs, we used to pick berries without any problems at all, and they were rampant. We could have berries all the time. Now they're illegal, the only berries, and they're hard to get hold of, and they're expensive. So the blackberries and the blueberries and the mulberries and all the things that grew wild in Australia don't anymore. You've got to spray blackberries and against the law to have a mulberry tree in your backyard. So we just don't get those concentrated ones, and it's hard to get them, or they're expensive. I in fact, find just supplementing with a tablet containing them is a good idea. I eat them when I can.
Yeah.
You know, I think they should be part of the normal daily diet.
I suppose also the blueberries we get in frozen packets are just as good when you thaw them out.
I don't have any problems with frozen ones, because we know that they freeze them when they're fresh. A lot of the so-called fresh foods are ripened off the vine, so they're not pulling up nutrients as they're ripening. So I think that the frozen ones, they've actually ripened for you, then they pick them, and then they freeze them. Whereas many of the fresh, so-called fresh oranges and so on, are picked before they're ripe, and then they're ripened off the vine. Well, they can't have the same amount of nutrient value in them, because they're no longer pulling up anything out of the soil.
And that, of course, would if people are talking about fresh food, it makes me worried, because half the stuff coming from the other side of the world anyway.
That's right, the definition of fresh. Isn't it funny? They say, fresh oranges all the way from Mexico. And you go, well, gee, my definition of fresh and that is totally different. Well, if you have a frozen one, and particularly if you buy good Australian produce, it's taken straight off the vine when it's ready to eat.
Yeah.
And it's not frozen. So I think they're good. I understand that they've got to do this. ripening off the vine because we've got so many people to get into. And also, oranges are a seasonal thing, but we can eat them all year round. And that's not because they're growing in Australia all year round. It's because we bring them in from the Northern Hemisphere.
Right, indeed. Now, to go back to the original thing, black tea, a couple of mugfuls of black tea a day are going to be good for us generally, and we don't actually need to add the milk.
No, we don't need to add the milk. And, I mean, if you're a dairy farmer, adding the milk's a good idea. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with that. And I think the only thing it does is dilute it a little bit for the catechins, but there are benefits with milk as well. And I think that we've got to look at these. Tea, of course, is a herb. Green tea, black tea are all herbs. There are many other diuretic herbs. Celery seed is a good one. Juniper was used for many years. And these can help with people who've got a little bit of fluid retention. Dandelion is another one that's good. But the artery stiffness, well, that's the antioxidants in its highest.
Some of the Sydney Writers Festival's brightest stars come together to examine power and its relationship to sex, money, politics, identity, and the state of the world. Featuring best-selling author Tayari Jones, Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Wesley Morris, Tech Lady Mafia founder Amanitu Sow, Deputy Opposition Leader Tanya Plibersek, and more. 8:30 p.m. May 4 at Sydney Town Hall. Tickets on sale now. 2SER is a proud media partner of Sydney Writers Festival.
107.3 FM. 2SER.
Now, we're all worried about the psychology behind Facebook's data breach. Facebook has said it believes that up to 87 million users' data was inappropriately shared with Cambridge Analytical. Cambridge Analytical claims the data and research helped Donald Trump with his US presidency. But how did it turn a Facebook user's database into a personality type, and what did it do with the information? This story care of the BBC.
The big data company Cambridge Analytica used an algorithm capable of psychologically profiling users from their Facebook interactions alone. But how does it work? The Big Five personality test has been used by psychologists for years. It scores you on five core traits. Openness. Do you welcome new experiences? Conscientiousness. How much of a perfectionist are you? Extroversion. Do you love a party? Agreeableness. How compassionate are you to others? And neuroticism. Do you often worry or get easily upset? Blended together, these broad traits sort people into personality types. For example, this is the adventurer. She's open, a bit neurotic, and loves variety. Or a protector. Agreeable, extroverted, he thinks of others. Or an executive. Conscientious and open, she's a natural leader. And the algorithm? It's been proved impressively accurate. With just 10 likes, and it's better at guessing what kind of person you are than your colleagues. 150 likes, it's more accurate than your parents. And just 300 likes, it's better at predicting your personality score than your partner. But every day we share more than just likes. Our digital footprint is a vast, ever-growing web of status posts, shares, messages, photos, all of which provide Facebook further insight into who we are. Cambridge Analytica were employed by President Trump's campaign during the 2016 US elections. The company's former boss, Alexander Nix, claimed before the election to have predicted the Big Five score of every adult in America. But what did they do with that information? On Facebook, hundreds of adverts were posted every day, targeted at specific personality types tailored towards people's innermost fears, needs, and emotions. For example, one of Donald Trump's key pledges was to defend the Second Amendment, the right of the individual to carry a gun. It was a user's Big Five score which dictated which advert landed in their newsfeed. For example, the adventurer. The open-minded, but often impulsive, sometimes nervous individual might have seen something like this. An advert sending a message that freedom must be protected from outside threats. Or, for the protector, the guardian, an advert like this, suggesting guns are an essential tool in safeguarding others. And finally, the executive, the rational-thinking forward planner, receives a message about protecting her family and the future. But can big data win an election? Cambridge Analytica claim it did. They say it was their data and their research that gave President Trump the winning margin. But that's near impossible to prove. No one can track in retrospect who voted which way because of which advert. There are simply too many variables. Political parties around the world will be considering the lessons of Cambridge Analytica. The big data genie is out of the bottle. But will it change the adverts you see in your next election? And will those adverts change your mind?
That disturbing story, care of the BBC. Just a gentle reminder, we love your donations, and if you can visit our website and keep us on air, we'd much appreciate it. In 1991, the last of Sydney's hydrofoils, the Curlcull, was withdrawn from service. Now, nearly 30 years later, one man is on a mission to return it to its spiritual home right here in Sydney. Producer Max Manhood spoke to Andrew Highway, the man in charge with returning the Curlcull hydrofoil to its former glory.
To start us off, for those of us who aren't sure, could you describe what a hydrofoil is and how it works?
Sure. Well, a hydrofoil is a high-speed form of transport. And what makes it unique is that it has what you would consider to be skis underneath the boat. And when the boat is moving fast enough, the skis actually enable the whole of the hull of the vessel to rise out of the water. So basically, the boat is flying on these wings or foils, if you like. And the advantage of this is that you can go faster. You can also do this more economically because, you know, you're not fighting the forces of water with the hull of the ship because the hull is flying over the water. So it's a very efficient form of high-speed transport.
The Sydney Hydrofoils, how did you come in contact with them?
Well, my father used to be an airline pilot for British Airways. And in the 1980s, British Airways ran Sydney as a hub, if you like. And so there were a number of pilots and their families living in Australia at any time during the 1980s. And my father did quite a few of these postings over there. From 1981, 1982 till 1988, I actually spent quite a lot of my youth in Sydney, and we were living in Manly as a family. And I even actually went to school in Manly for a period of time as well. And during this time, because we lived in Manly, whenever we went to Sydney, we would travel over on the hydrofoils. And I just got fascinated with these amazing craft, these really graceful craft that, you know, flew at high speeds over the water, spray flying everywhere. And it was just a really exciting form of transport. There was nothing else like it. I'd never seen anything else like it. And I fell in love with the hydrofoils during this period.
I mean, it does sound like a lot of fun, but when you decided to track the hydrofoils down, what was your motivation for preserving them and returning them to Sydney?
I had a contact, if you like, who was a friend of mine, who ran an industry publication called Fast Ferry International. And every couple of years, I would call him up and we'd just have a conversation about hydrofoils. And inevitably, I would always ask him, well, what about the Sydney hydrofoils? What are they doing now? Are they still running? And he kept telling me about one, which was the Curlcull, that was apparently sat in very good condition on a beach in Messina in Sicily. And I said, well, what's it doing there? And he didn't know. I said, what, is she for sale? You know, is she just, is somebody going to bring her back on the water? And again, he didn't know. And this went on, and I believe I was having these conversations with him at around 2006, 2007, something like that. Okay. So every couple of years, I'd call him up. But my first question was always, do you have any news on the Curlcull? And it actually got to the stage, and we're going back now to most recently, which would have been January 2016. And I asked him, I said, is the Curlcull still on the beach in Messina? He said, well, I haven't heard anything about her for a while, but hold on, let me check. And what he did, because he knew whereabouts it was located, and he went to Google Earth and came back with a photo for me and said, well, look, she's still here on Google Earth. Now, wow. Who knows how old this image is? It could be anything up to a year or more, you know, older. But she is there. And it was a very hazy photograph. You could tell it was Curlcull, but you couldn't tell anything about her condition.
I see.
So my next question was, well, is she still called Curlcull? I don't know why I'd never asked that question in the past. And he said, no, she was renamed Spargy when she returned to Italy in 1992. So at that point then, my interest was really rekindled at this point. And so I was determined to find out, you know, was she still out there on this mystical beach I've been hearing about for the last 10 years? And I started doing sort of Google searches, and I came across this website called GoBid, GoBid.it, which is like an Italian version of eBay.
Sure.
And sure enough, there she was on this auction site. And I thought, wow, you know, I can't believe it. And have I actually missed this? Because the auction had ended about 4 months earlier. Well, it was October 2015, the auction had ended. So I started doing some digging. And I actually called up the owners of this GoBid, this auction website, and said, you know, is this Hydroforce still for sale? And they said, we think you're too late, but hold on, we'll check. So they came back to me a few days later and said, sorry, we've spoken to the owners of the vessel, and you're too late. She's been destroyed. I thought, you know, I'm not really one to take no for an answer. And until, you know, somebody, I hear from somebody who's standing next to a pile of scrap metal and says, yes, this is the Curl, you know, I thought maybe there's still a chance, still a possibility.
Okay.
So I then found out that the shipyard where she had been staying for all of these years, and through the manufacturer, actually, and it's really quite funny because the manufacturer of the ship is only about 800 meters, located 800 meters away from the shipyard where she's now resting. So, and this shipyard is well known for being, let's say, the last resting home for hydrofoils. You know, is where hydrofoils go to get scrapped a lot of the
time. It's like a hydrofoil graveyard.
Exactly, absolutely, yeah, like a hydrofoil graveyard, but she'd been sitting there in dry dock for, well, at this point, approximately 12 years.
How can people follow your journey, and how can they find out more about your journey with the Curl hydrofoil?
After I'd heard about all of this, my wife and I flew over to Messina, and we arranged a special deal with the shipyard, if you like, and it was a particularly special deal because it was based on them doing the refurbishment work. So the next step now, I mean, I've just been to Sydney to raise publicity for what we're doing, and there's been a huge amount of enthusiasm for what we're doing. It really sparks memories in people's minds, and people remembering back to, you know, for them, maybe better days on Sydney Harbour back in the 70s and the 80s. So for me, this became a lifelong journey. I had to do this. I had to refurbish her, and I had to bring her back to Australia. Mm. So I've raised publicity for her now. We are talking to a number of commercial partners to help fund her, because obviously, you know, restoring a hydrofoil like the Curl, putting brand new, you know, economic engines into her, and then bringing her back to Sydney, that there is obviously a cost associated with this.
Sure.
So I'm looking at commercial partners, and I've had a lot of interest so far, and over the next sort of 3 or 4 months we're looking to sort of tie up these commercial deals. Mm. And then actually do the restoration of Curl at the end of this year. So probably from October this year till January, February next year, we'll do the restoration. Then we'll do sea trials on the Straits of Messina to make sure, you know, she's working perfectly. Mm. And then, I mean, the original plan was actually then to bring her back to Australia on the back of a container ship, which is the way that all the hydrofoils actually arrived in Sydney over the years. But then I got thinking, as I was getting quotations coming in for this, and they were really crazy prices, I thought to myself, you know, this is a huge adventure in itself. Why not make this an even bigger adventure by actually bringing her back under her own power from Messina to Sydney? And I thought, well, just so I'm not completely crazy with this idea myself, I'll speak to some people who actually know about this. And I know quite a few ship captains and a few hydrofoil captains in Italy as well. And I consulted them and I said, am I crazy? Can we do this? And they basically all said, it is absolutely doable with the right planning.
That was producer Max Mahut speaking to Andrew Highway, the man in charge of bringing Curl, the hydrofoil, back to Sydney Harbour.
107.3 FM. 2SER.
And that music means we're out of time. You've been listening to Panacea on 107.3. Your health program comes in every Tuesday night. Remember, this is Donation Week again, so if you visit 2SER and keep us alive with your donations, we much appreciate it. In the meantime, you have a great week. I'm Quentin Strawley, signing off. Coming up next, it's a question of balance.